everyone. Before we start, I wanted to let you know, if you would like to watch our whole service, head to our website. That's dc2.me. And from the media drop-down, click sermons. You can watch our whole service there. And now, here's this week's sermon.
Good morning, Discovery. My name is Zach. I'm one of the pastors here and delighted to get to be with you this morning. Before we get too far into our teaching for today, just had a brief announcement. We have been saying the last few weeks we're still looking for a few more folks to volunteer in our children's ministry downstairs on Sunday mornings. Last week, I actually got to hang out in the early elementary classroom, and I will say more than once the thought ran through my head, why am I not down here every Sunday? And that I can say because I have that weird wiring that some of us have in the room of like, I just love hanging out and playing with kids. So I want to be real clear with this invitation. Some of us have skills that are different than that. And I think for some of us, you'd be like, I do not want to hang out with kids, but if Zach's asking me to, I guess I'll do it. Don't worry about it. You don't have to worry about it. But for those of you that are like, I do enjoy hanging out with kids. We've got so many young kids that are getting baptized in the coming months. Not only that, but some of those kids are not just early elementary school. We need some folks to hang out with some teenagers because we've got a rash of teenage kids that are being baptized right now, let alone those are just the ones being baptized. What about the ones that are coming on a Wednesday night that they don't know anything about Jesus? We've got so many kids who just need somebody to walk alongside them. So would love to just ask you, would you consider that? We are at a spot where we need 5 more volunteers for downstairs with children's. This year, our youth ministry group, our student ministry, took 10 times as many kids to camp as we took 2 years ago. Yeah, we took 3 years, 2 kids ago, so 2 years ago, so rough math, but we're growing a lot. And if we're going to be taking care of this next generation of folks, we just got to have more help down there. So if I can just make a shameless plug and say, if you like kids, particularly if you love kids, we need you. Let's get into our teaching for today. As Drew said, we are rounding out our study in the book of 1 Peter, and today we find ourselves in the last chapter, chapter 5, and some of the last verses, verses 9 through 11. We're going to read today out of the Message translation because I'm feeling spicy. So here's what we got. Keep your guard up. You're not the only ones plunged into these hard times. It's the same with Christians all over the world. So keep a firm grip on the faith. The suffering won't last forever. It won't be long before this generous God who has great plans for us in Christ, eternal and glorious plans they are, will have you put together and on your feet for good. He gets the last word. Yes, he does. Sometimes as a pastor and a preacher, there's moments that come where you have to say something really divisive. And today is one of those days. And I've really wrestled with how do I say this in a way that feels kind and respectful. And I think I've just resigned myself to, I just got to say it. The first 3 Star Wars movies are the only good Star Wars movies. I am a huge Star Wars fan, massive, massive Star Wars fan. So don't hear me saying I refuse to watch any other. I will watch any of them at any given time. They're just not that good. But the first 3, am I right? I mean, the first 3, I think what got me, even as a kid when I was watching them for the first time, is you've got this small group of resistance fighters and they don't have a snowball's chance of making it happen. And as you track the story, there's a wild genogram that makes its way in and somebody's dad and he doesn't know, and then there's twins. It's crazy. But really at the core of the story is a common story that you find in every civilization. And it just resonates with the heart of a human being. This idea that, man, something's wrong in the world. And it seems like only a few of us really know what's going on, and we are willing to fight for that. And we know we really don't have that much of a shot. But we're going to do it because it's the right thing to do. And then freaking Jar Jar Binks. What happened? And the wheels just fall off. Those original 3. And that's why it's the resistance fighters. That's what got me. And I think it's because it's my story. It resonates with me and my civilization. Have you ever found yourself in a place and in a system that it just felt like it needed a change? Have you ever had the sense of like, am I part of the resistance or am I part of the evil empire? We started out this year in the series on heaven, which I frankly loved. I hope that you did. If you didn't, I'm so sorry you don't like thinking about heaven for many reasons. But as we were talking about heaven, it just paints this picture as you think about it that makes you go, yes, like I cannot wait. And we hold in tension the fact that when Jesus, all through his life, keeps saying, the kingdom of heaven is here. I have come to bring the kingdom. When you pray, pray that on earth it may be like it is in heaven. It's not just some far off place that we're waiting for someday. There is a tension of, no, it's here and now. How do we live here and now? Because this does not look like the heaven that I read about. So how, as a follower of this Jesus and as a citizen of this kingdom in heaven, how do I live now? And that's why we went straight from this study in heaven into this book of 1 Peter, because this is exactly the stuff that 1 Peter's covering for this group of churches that are spread all across modern-day Turkey. He's saying, okay, first of all, we do have this resistance band of fighters. We've got this residence in heaven. We know what we're fighting for. Who's invited to this thing? And as we've read through this book of 1 Peter, it turns out everyone's invited. What are they supposed to do? Well, we found out really early on, their job is to make God known, to share this kingdom, to bring this kingdom here, to fight for that. But also we find out, what are they supposed to do? You're going to suffer a lot. And if you were here last week, goodness gracious, Jen Diebel, what a gift. And I love his honesty as we get now here to the end of his letter to these churches. It's clear that Peter is certainly calling his people to change the world around them, but how really matters. How do you change a system? How do you change people, particularly when you're the one who's hurting and suffering and relatively powerless to do anything? It's a great question for us in our day and age, modern day America. Some of you have really struggled with the memory verse. I will say I am one of those as we started out this series. And if you still want to grab one, there's several out in the lobby. But we started out this series with 1 Peter chapter 2, verses 13 through 17, and just said, hey, you want to memorize this? This would be a great way to engage the study on 1 Peter. But it's wild. And some of you might have read that first week and have been like, I'm not doing this. And that would have been a perfectly reasonable response. Let me read to you what some of us have been memorizing. It goes like this. Submit yourselves, for the Lord's sake, to every human authority, whether to the emperor as the supreme authority or to his governors who are sent by him to punish those who do wrong and to commend those who do right. For it is God's will that by doing good you should silence the ignorant talk of foolish people. Live as free people. Do not use your freedom as an excuse to do evil. Live as God's slaves. Show proper respect to everyone. Love the family of believers. Fear God. Honor the emperor. It's weird. If you read this too quickly, it looks like Peter, who's writing to this group of early Christians in Turkey who are part of the Roman Empire, a Roman Empire with the Emperor Nero, who's actively coming after and murdering Christians, usually in the Colosseum, sometimes using them like lamps to light his parties by lighting them on fire at night. It looks like, if we look too quickly, Peter's just saying, hey guys, just chill out. I know Nero's coming after us, I know he's killing us, he's feeding us now. Just chill out and go with the flow. And for us, no matter what goes on in the world, whatever injustices, whatever wars, whatever evil, that for us Christians here in modern Turkey in the Roman Empire, we should just chain smoke it out until ignorance is bliss. This is no big deal. And when we read that, if we read that for their context, and when we read that and read that for our context, something about that just makes our heads spin a little bit. Surely not. Is that what Peter is asking these folks to do? Today's lesson, we're just going to be really looking at a 30,000-foot level over the entire book of 1 Peter. What have we learned as we've gone through this study? And if this is the idea that Peter's been talking about the whole time, whether we're talking about make him known or suffering or submitting, now at the end, he's reminding these Christians that Christians all over the globe, and I think we can safely assume Christians all throughout time, that they've been wrestling with these same problems, it would seem like it would be a good idea to jump back into Christian history and consider, how have Christians been wrestling with this? What are we supposed to do? How did they hold the tension between submitting to the emperors, but also not doing evil? All of which comes out of chapter 2. Chapter 2, just so we're clear, that verse was chosen because it sits literally at the center of the book of 1 Peter. And 1 Peter, I think, as a good Jewish writer, cannot get himself away from this writing style that Jewish people would have, that you would put your most important idea in the very center of the work. It's called a chiasm. We can get into that at a later time. This is the point, this memory verse. Everything centers around this thought. So what did he mean? Let's dig into some church history. You good for some stories today? This is one thing I think I would love to get better at. Jesus did this all the time. He's like, let's just tell stories. And I hope that you can grab the truth, because there's kernels of it littered all throughout this story. Hope you can grab onto those as we go, because I'm just not going to give it to you right on the nose. Here's some stories from church history. The first two are from Peter's lifetime. Peter had some familiarity with change in the world around. Currently, as he's writing the book of 1 Peter, Peter is in Rome, like he's at the Death Star writing this thing, and he would have likely heard about some of his friends back in Jerusalem. Some really hard things had been going on. Right around AD 66, there was a Roman governor who was kind of the one in charge of all Judea at the time over Israel, and one day just waltzed into the temple. This is like the holiest place. Like, I think the closest I can like paint a picture for you now is if you went into the heart of Islam, in the heart of Saudi Arabia, and you just pillaged their most holy sites. Not just stealing money, but stealing relics and things that were so important to them. I mean, you'd incite a riot. This Roman governor just waltzed right into the temple in Jerusalem and started taking things, claiming that they were taxes owed to Caesar and that he had to take them. And as you can understand, rioting broke out all over Jerusalem. There was a particular group of folks, kind of like the green berets of the Jewish folks, the zealots. I mean, this is like the final straw. This just broke them in half. And they took out everyone they could find. If you were a Roman citizen living in town, for sure if you were a Roman soldier, massive, massive war. And history would continue to look back on this time and call it the Great Jewish Revolt. And the thing about this story is that it's a really sad story. In response, Nero, the emperor, ends up sending 3 legions of soldiers to Jerusalem. And within 2 years, Rome has control of the province again. But the craziest part of the story, which many of you likely know, is that in an act of retaliation, he just burns the temple to the ground. Which again, I think for us, we go, that sounds bad. Imagine burning Islam's most holiest sites to the ground. I mean, it's not just violence. There's something so wrong, like on a spiritual, like that's, everything has been violated. It's a rough story. But as we look at both the Romans and the Jews that are involved in this story, if we're asking the question today, how do you change the world? Their philosophy is that you fight. It's rough. And this, I think, would have reminded Peter of a second story for today, a personal story, one that we'll move far too quickly through. But it's a time when someone tried to take something from his God too, and a time when he also struck out with a sword. It was the night before Jesus went to the cross, and he was with all of his friends in the Garden of Gethsemane. Jesus, his teacher, his rabbi, was off praying, and all of a sudden, from a roused sleep that many of us are familiar with on this daylight savings, torches and pitchforks come over the horizon, and they are clearly coming to arrest Jesus. And with the temperature in the room at the time, Peter, as well as everybody else, knows this is not going to end well. One of the servants of one of the guys who is coming to arrest Jesus starts to lay his hands on him, and Peter, just in a moment of pure passion, wanting to defend his friend, whips out a sword and takes a swipe at the dude's head. Thank God that Peter's a fisherman and not a soldier, because he misses horribly and just nicks off the guy's ear, which I like close. And Jesus has this wild interaction with him. He turns to Peter And as I imagine the story, a look of like near betrayal on his face of like, what are you doing? Put the sword away. And he bends down and he picks up Malchus's ear and he sprays some antiseptic on it and he puts it back on his head. And then he gets hauled off. And he goes to a trial that's incredibly unjust. And then he goes to another one that's incredibly unjust. And then he is tortured and beaten and then drug up a hill and crucified and he dies. And Peter watches this whole thing happen. Two very different stories. How do you change the world? And I think as Peter now, as an old man, sitting in the Death Star of Rome, is writing a letter to his friends in Asia, he's seeing these two options once again, and he's watching the same story play out. We've got Nero, he's lighting people on fire, he's killing Christians just because they're Christians, and he's looking between the two saying, should we fight or should we put our swords away? And I think with a lived experience, he watched how his rabbi engaged the world around, and it's pretty clear to him what he's supposed to tell them to do. But Peter, here at the end, he reminds these folks in these churches in Turkey that they're not the only ones. We just read it at the beginning, that it's the same with Christians all over the world. And I think very clearly we can say, and throughout time. One thing I loved a couple weeks ago as Steve Cuss was preaching on this idea of submission is that he said, in this culture, there was not a very strong sense of agency. It's not like in America where you have the ability to vote, you have the ability to act. We're very individualistic. It's a very different culture where you were just kind of stuck. They didn't have much agency. So it's great to hear 1 Peter 5 and 1 Peter 2, to hear about the great Jewish revolt and hear about Malchus's ear. Totally different thing if we go, how does this look in like our time? What about in a political system that's more near to us? And in a culture that's more individualistic. So two more stories as we're moving quickly through our day. These are both from the 20th century. This first one starts in 1929 when Mahatma Gandhi wrote a letter to America. And the title of the letter was called To the American Negro. And he addressed it to every black person living in America, but he addressed it to W.E.B. Du Bois, famous poet and leader at the time, black guy. And it was really just a note saying, what's going on with racism in America? Because we're having some fights here in India trying to figure this out, and you guys have a real similar problem. We should start sharing notes. And there was a group of teenagers in India called the Indian Student Christian Movement. And they knew about the situation in the U.S. They'd heard about this letter that Gandhi had sent, and they saw an opportunity. And man, freaking teenagers. They write a letter to a group of American pastors, all black, and they say, hey, we'd love to have you guys come over and just go around teaching, and then we'd like, maybe we can figure out how to introduce you to Gandhi himself. And one of the kids that gets invited, one of these preachers, just 37 years old, was a dude named Howard Thurman. And he wanted to learn from the Indian Student Christian Movement. He for sure wanted to meet with Gandhi. So he jumps on a plane and spends 140 days giving 135 lectures and sermons in over 50 cities. He ends up speaking with Nobel laureates, with different leaders from all sorts of different countries through South Asia. Whirlwind of a trip. As somebody who speaks publicly once a week, 135 and 140 days, this dude is exhausted. I don't know how he did this. But it was at the end of the trip that Howard Thurman finally got to meet Mahatma Gandhi. They had a 3-hour-long conversation, and both men left changed. But for Thurman, he was hearing not only the philosophy of the stories behind Gandhi's nonviolent approach, but he was continuing to connect dots between the character of Jesus, who he loved, and the position of black Christians in America. Gandhi had explained that non-injury or nonviolence was not a negative force, and that's why he loved it so much. Nonviolence is not harmful. In its most practical terms, nonviolent response is love, that is, Gandhi would say, self-acting, but even more, and when embodied by a single individual, it bears a force more powerful than hate and violence and can transform the world. Thurman would come home to pen his profound book, Jesus and the Disinherited, which if you have not read, and if you enjoy reading, please buy this book. This is a book that Martin Luther King Jr. would carry around through the entire time of the 1950s. And the central theme of that book is this: the act of love as redemptive suffering is not contingent on the other person's response. Love, rather, is an unsolicited self-giving. It transcends merit and demerit. It simply loves. In Jesus and the Disinherited, Thurman says this: it is true that a man cannot be serene unless he possesses something about which to be serene. Here we reach the high water mark of prophetic religion, and it is of the essence of the religion of Jesus of Nazareth. Of course God cares for the grass of the field, which lives every day, which lives a day and is no more, or the sparrow that falls unnoticed by the wayside. He also holds the stars in their appointed places, leaves his mark on every living thing, and he cares for me. To be assured of this becomes the answer to the threat of violence, yea, to the violence itself. To the degree to which a man knows this, he is unconquerable from within and without. In many ways, I think that sounds like parts of 1 Peter, doesn't it? For Thurman, this wasn't just a good philosophy he was pilfering from a friend in India. For Thurman, he was discovering the way of Jesus, both in how it looked externally, but really he was discovering how he was going to help lead the civil rights movement from a spiritual level. You can only engage nonviolent protest like this if you possess something about which to be serene. And Thurman knew that he had it. And so he worked with black leaders across the country. At the time he was teaching at Boston University and he was mentoring a couple kids. One of them he took under his wing a little more than others. He served as his spiritual direction for a while. That kid turned out to be Martin Luther King Jr. And it's one of the heroic stories of our era. As Steve pointed out, the civil rights movement, which was really guided and led for sure by Martin Luther King, but spiritual director and his mentor, Howard Thurman, saying, when they beat you, look into their eyes. Let them see your humanity. And might that be something that would connect us as brothers and sisters? You can only hold that kind of serenity when you know that the God of the universe cares for you. This was not just a strategic move. It's a move that's rooted in spirituality. That they could hold on to something serene even in the midst of their present suffering, that they could forgive the other, knowing that the real enemy was not the evil in the human, but the evil behind the human. Ultimately, they were training people in the civil rights movement to just understand the way of Jesus. And because of them, because of these stories, our question today, how do you change the world? If you ask Howard Thurman, I think he'd say something to the effect of, you submit to what's happening and you do what's right. Here's another story. Another Christian who was plunging into some hard times. He was a contemporary of Thurman's, a guy that you probably have heard of a little bit more, by the name of Dietrich Bonhoeffer. As a young man, Bonhoeffer had no problem with violence, but one day in his late 20s, maybe early 30s, was studying the Sermon on the Mount and became convinced, he said, everything depends on the renewal of the church in a time of impending war. And nonviolence must be our response. The lifestyle that Jesus talked about in that sermon is the clear and obvious way that the church should follow Jesus. As the National Socialist Party rose in Germany, they began drafting young men, and Bonhoeffer did a couple really unorthodox things. The first is someone who was a theologian really involved in the church life. And if we're talking Germany, we're talking mainly the Lutheran Church of a long time ago Germany. Let's just keep that clear. He just went around telling young men to avoid the draft, and that if they got drafted, that the places where it was right for a young man to serve would be either as a medic or maybe as a chaplain. And that didn't fly too well with the Gestapo. In 1933, because of this, they labeled him an enemy of the state. That was one really weird thing that there were not a lot of theologians or pastors doing in his time. The second thing that he did that was really weird was he left Germany. He came to the United States to live in Harlem, New York, for a while. He hung out with a bunch of friends. They were at Union Seminary, to this day, a phenomenal place. But that move was also short-lived. With many opportunities to remain overseas, Bonhoeffer would ultimately return to Germany saying this, "I've come to the conclusion that I made a mistake coming to America," he wrote. "I shall have no right to take part in the restoration of Christian life in Germany after the war unless I share the trials of this time with my people. Christians of Germany will face a terrible alternative of either willing the defeat of their nation in order that Christian civilization may survive, or willing the victory of their nation and thereby destroying our civilization. I know which of these alternatives I must choose, but I cannot make that choice in security." So he comes back home to Germany, and he would work right away with his friend Karl Barth, as they were penning something that would be called the Barman Declaration. It was a declaration that would be signed by 7,000 pastors who wanted to take a stand against the puppet church that the Nazis were trying to hold up. The Nazis' church kind of looked like this. Hitler's God, he justified the hatred of select groups of people. And Hitler's God really sought the economical dominance of the country over the rest of the world, and of seeing suffering as the antithesis of godliness. That was the good news of Hitler's God. And the Barman Declaration addressed the church's freedom to preach the gospel, and in particular to stand alongside marginalized and suffering people. 7,000 pastors may sound like a lot. There were 20,000 pastors in Germany at the time, so the movement right out of the gate was already a minority. And everyone who signed that document immediately became persecuted. That group would ultimately decide that they needed a seminary and they would need someone to run it. And so Bonhoeffer threw his name in the hat and in his early 30s was the president of a seminary, like you do. And funny enough, to take that appointment, he had to turn down a meeting with a guy named Mahatma Gandhi in India, where he was going to go talk about how do you do nonviolent protest. School would ultimately be shut down by the Gestapo, which led to a whole new season of life for Bonhoeffer. He was still decrying war and violence, and he became a spy, double agent, working between the German resistance, Star Wars, and the Allies, still preaching, still leading Christians. Allegedly, he was a part of the assassination of Hitler. There's lots of good scholarship, actually, that might not have been the case. At his trial, if he was a part of that assassination attempt, you would absolutely expect the Nazis to be very clear, this is why we're going to punish you, because you tried to kill our emperor. But what he gets convicted of is three things. One, you're guilty of evading the draft. Guilty as charged. Two, Bonhoeffer had just helped 14 Jewish people escape the country. Convicted of that, guilty as charged. Number three, convicting you of continuing to stand up to the national church. Guilty as charged. Nothing in there about assassination. But even if he was a part of the assassination attempt, I think it actually helps our conversation today because it brings up attention. What about those of us in the room who serve or have served as policemen or women, who have been in the military? Does the ethics of nonviolence have exceptions? If the kingdom of heaven is on earth, how do we live with one foot in the kingdom of heaven and also holding the tension of what it means to live in the political system of America or the 21st century? It's so hard and nuanced. And I love Bonhoeffer because at least today we don't have enough time. I mean, these are like coffee table conversations. They're much more difficult to do from a stage, to talk about the nuance and the difficulty of ethics. That if we hold things like this as black and white, we may miss some things that God is up to. And I think the life of Bonhoeffer held this tension beautifully. Regardless of whether he made the move to assassinate Hitler or not, we see throughout his life a man who's trying to live in this tension between submit to the emperor and doing no evil all at once. Bonhoeffer's closest friend, a guy named Eberhard Bethke, retells this story. He says, at about 3 or 4 in the afternoon, Dietrich's father came in from the unit next door and said, Dietrich, there are 2 men who have come to speak to you. You must come over. And so Dietrich went over, of course, always in total discipline, being prepared that something like that one day will happen, and now it had happened. Those 2 men had come to arrest him, to take him to a prison in Berlin, where he was interrogated and tortured. Ultimately, he'd be moved to a concentration camp where he would be hanged, just 11 days before Allied forces came and liberated that particular camp. He was willing to take the punishment for his choices as an act of submission. He was not willing to use his freedom as an excuse to do evil, but to do good. What would have been evil was to have just gone along with it. Whatever Germany's doing, whatever the emperor's into, just submit, condone it, go along with it. That's evil. So for him, how do you change the world? If you're Dietrich Bonhoeffer, I think he would say something the effect of, you submit to what's happening, and you do right. And in the murkiness of his story, it provides a gritty and deep conversation for today, and this leads us to our last story, and this is the story of us. How do we change the world? This little band of resistance fighters, in the ways where we see what heaven is like and we desire to see that reality of heaven come to earth and be here, how do we do that? How do you change things? And there are 2 main categories of options, and hopefully today you're seeing them in relative clarity. These are options that are offered to anyone, whether you call yourself a follower of Jesus or not. The first goes like this. In the immortal words of the great theologians, the Beastie Boys, you've got to fight for your right to party. What is it that you believe? What is your worldview? How much can you impose it on the world around? This is a worldview that can be held by Christians just as easily as it can be held by atheists. And really, at the heart of this worldview is this: you're on your own. The world is cruel, and it's filled with suffering. At the very least, you must fight for your sense of comfort, for your worldview to be victorious. Your ability to change the world will depend on your ability to impose your will on it. So when the Roman Empire attacks the temple, you respond in kind. You take your pound of flesh in revenge. Why? Because you're on your own and it's up to you. When the civil rights and liberties are called into action, you choose what some have certainly done, and you simply respond with violence and demands instead of nonviolence and vulnerability with things like marches or even sit-ins. And your enemies become people in this worldview, not evil. You submit to no one except for your own understanding of what you think is right. And as you pray, you don't really pray that God's kingdom would come, but only that your version of God's kingdom would come as you want it to. And whether you're conservative or liberal, I think on any side of the aisle, this is a story that many choose to live. And it is not the way of Jesus. If I'm honest, I think as I look at this worldview and I go, well, that's clearly the wrong one. I'm glad I'm not there. I think if I'm honest, I read about a Jesus who says, if you look at someone you're not married to with lust in your heart, you've committed adultery. And then if you think about someone with murder in your heart, it doesn't matter if you actually kill them or not, we've got a problem going on. And it is so easy for me to look at this particular way of responding to how do you change the world and go, yeah, that's not right. I don't have to worry about that when I do. Because there are people in the world, people in my immediate circle, things that I pray for globally. There is murder in my heart, and I have to be willing to do justice to that with myself. That's one way of addressing how do you change the world. The second story goes a little bit like this. Here's your other option. Submit yourselves to the Lord's sake, to every human authority, whether to the emperor as the supreme authority or to governors who are sent by him to punish those who do wrong and to commend those who do right. For it is God's will that by doing good, you should silence the ignorant talk of foolish people. Live as free people, but do not use your freedom as a cover-up for evil. Live as God's slaves. Show proper respect to everyone. Love the family of believers. Fear God. Honor the emperor. And as we get through our study on 1 Peter, I hope that you can see the teeth and the passion in this particular passage. Peter is not screwing around. He's looking at a great Jewish revolt, and he's looking at his rabbi going, whew, this is a tall order. The most courageous thing I can invite any other human being to do. So church in Turkey, deep persecution, getting roughed up. What are we going to do? We're going to submit. And we're going to do what's right. Here's the tension. We will refuse to engage in evil. We will do what is good. We will be willing to take the punishment as an act of submission. It sounds a lot like another passage in Scripture to me, written by another dude to another church in another part of the world right around the same time, written by a guy named Paul to a church in Philippi. And Paul writes it like this. Do nothing out of selfish ambition or vain conceit. Rather, in humility, value others above yourselves, not looking to your own interests, but each of you to the interests of others. In relationships with one another, have the same attitude as that of Christ, who being in the very nature God, did not consider equality with God something to be used to his own advantage. Rather, he made himself nothing. And by taking the very nature of a servant and being made in human likeness, and being found in appearance as a man, he humbled himself by becoming obedient to death, even death on a cross. And here is when we really get into it for today. We live this way as followers of Jesus because this is how Jesus lives towards us every day. We choose to live unjustly, and we steal, and we lie, and I commit murder in my heart, and Jesus does not impose himself. This is not a story that says he will throw a lightning bolt and blight you from the earth the moment you put a toe out of line, but this God is also not a doormat who simply submits to whatever we want to do and whoever we want to be and just says, yeah, whatever you want, I'm going to chain smoke myself into bliss. Jesus remains true. He never compromises what is just and good, and he keeps the invitation extended to us at all times. Jesus submits to us, allowing us to choose and remaining with us on the journey, whether we choose what is evil or what is good. And what's even crazier to me is that he's willing to take the punishment for our bad choices if we allow him to. That's where he takes his level of submission. That's wild love. What a story. And in submitting and staying with us, incarnating us to him, to ourselves through his Holy Spirit, he wins the opportunity to do good in our lives. Just as Peter wins the opportunity to do good in Rome, and these churches in Asia win the opportunity to do good in Turkey, Thurman wins the opportunity to lead a movement of freedom and justice, Bonhoeffer wins the right to shine light in the darkest place. This Jesus who submits is no weakling. And in fact, he's the most tremendous act of strength that you can find. He's willing to die. He's willing to lay down his own desires so that we can retain the ability to choose, and in seeing his goodness, ultimately choose him and his way and to stop doing evil. Could it be that as Peter's trying to help these churches understand how they're supposed to navigate life in a cruel and unjust world, he's simply asking them to live out the lifestyle of their master? Not to be a doormat, but to always extend an invitation to what is right. Not to do evil by complying with an evil culture, but to always do the just and merciful and humble thing, even if it means taking the consequence and the punishment. Not to fight back using violence and imposition, but to submit using love and invitation. Could it be that Peter, despite his story, despite cutting off Malchus's ear, now in a more mature season of his spiritual life, gets a deep spiritual truth that he's trying to pass along? If you want to change the world, change it through submission. Jesus wanted to change the world. He changed it through submission. Peter, now only a couple years away from his own murder, he changed the church and the world through his submission. And if you want to change the world, you change it through submission. And you'll only understand how to do that if you allow Jesus to do it for you. Every now and again, we'll have what we call a contemplative moment here at Discovery. And sometimes this is a time where we'll offer you a minute or two just to think on this question. Today's not one of those kind of days, but I did want to offer a contemplative moment for today. Because at the core of this story, there are so many ways that we can take this. Ways of like, how do we get involved in the world? And how do we affect this change? How do we submit? But man, if we're going to get it, ultimately it comes with paying attention to how is Jesus submitting to you? So these are questions that I would encourage you as you go out the doors today, and maybe as you mull this over, these are the best things I think to think about. Before you consider your actions and your lifestyle, consider Christ first. What's he doing for you? No doubt this is a hard teaching. I can only imagine the faces of the people in the room as they're reading this letter from Peter in Rome for the first time. And as he gets it to the end, let me read this one more time for us, not just as this is what somebody wrote in a letter to somebody else one time, but these are words for us today. 1 Peter 5, 9 through 11, in the Message, because I'm feeling spicy. Keep your guard up. You're not the only ones plunged into these hard times. It's the same with Christians all over the world and time. So keep a firm grip on the faith. Suffering won't last forever. It won't be long before this generous God, who has great plans for us in Christ, eternal and glorious plans they are, will have you put together and on your feet for good. He gets the last word. Yes, he does. For those that are able, let's stand and sing in response.